Welcome to the Beyond Jiu-Jitsu podcast. This is episode 154. I'm your co-host, Kieran Lefebvre, and I am joined by Adam Childs.
Kieran, my man, what is up? Episode 154. Yo. Hello, everyone. Let's do a quick little bit of catch up. So this was really only what we're talking about right before hitting record. You're competing this weekend.
Don't remind me.
So to bring everyone up to speed, a few weeks back, so a few episodes back, Kieran did like a small local competition just to kind of grease the wheels and some of the matches. I think I forget the title of the video, but it's on your YouTube. Last week, Kieran mentioned that he had put up the quickest sub, right? Was your quickest competition sub. So I don't know. Did you take the video down?
I just changed the title. So you're referencing it.
Yeah. So the video's up there for, you know, but that comp was just to grease the wheels for this competition this weekend, which is more like the one that more people from the gym go to. It's, you know, so that's this weekend. How are you feeling about it?
Pretty relaxed, which, you know, is probably not a good sign.
But it's a bit of a drive, this one. It's a bit further. It's in Stockholm, which is how far for
it's
you?
About the same. It's actually about the same distance. If not, it might even be, we might even get there quicker. So the other competition was like 2 and a bit hours north. This one's 2 hours south. So it's 20 minutes north of Stockholm. So it's just outside of Stockholm. Sweden's capital, but it's to the northern side, and I am situated to the northern side of Stockholm, so it's closer than Stockholm is by a small fraction.
And is this an IBJJF competition?
This is IBJJF gi only. It's over 2 days. The first day is all the weight divisions.
But sorry to interrupt. What I meant, is it just as in IBJJF rules, or it's like the Stockholm Open, or it's like
IBJJF rules? It's not. Okay. I don't believe it's run by IBJJF. It's called Nordic. It's pretty big. Apparently, I haven't verified this, but it's one of the biggest, if not the biggest, gi competition in Sweden. But I would assume that they would have like an IBJJF run Stockholm Open, but maybe they don't. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right. Yep.
Maybe they don't. So this is like the competition of the year, in this part of the year anyway. Yeah.
And how many have they already? Can you already see registrations or brackets?
Yeah,
probably not brackets, but
no brackets yet. But registrations, I did have like 6 people in my bracket before I registered, which was a while ago. So you know. We both know that normally people, like a lot of the time, the people don't register until like, you know, the week of sort of thing, or like toward the end of cutoff point. Like that's when you get the most people actually registering to these events. So like looking months out, I know people that sit and wait and see how many people are blah, blah, blah. And so I'm just opening my Smooth Comp now and I'll get this up. But yeah, I'm not sure how many people.
So hopefully 2 or 3 fights.
You know, it would have to be at least 3.
Yeah. Have a look.
But yeah.
Yeah, it's, okay. That would only be because of the amount of divisions. Like, you're not going to be fighting over 2 days.
No. Well, if I did absolute, I would be over 2 days.
Right.
I'm not doing absolute divisions. So there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 people in my...
still the same.
Oh, that's interesting. I have someone from the same team I'm in. Our team is, I don't know this person. The dynamics, the team is quite large, expands over several gyms.
Yeah, right.
So I don't know. I've never heard of this gym. Whatever. There's one.
And two, so what three, weight four, division five, are you six, doing six, for this one?
88.
Yeah, nice. 88. My OG weight division, like bro. My OG weight division.
Yeah, it's really funny.
Can you believe that I used to fight 88? Like,
I can't even believe I'm fighting 88, to be honest. So my walk around weight is like, man, I weigh in. When people ask me at the gym, what do you weigh? I jump on the scales with my gi on, like before training. Sometimes I'm like 81, so I easily make 82. But I just, you know.
From memory, you did some comps at 82, right? It's not like you didn't make weight, but there were a couple of comps that you were just like, not as energetic or something. Like, I remember having a conversation with you where you said, nah, man, fuck 82. I'm doing 88.
Yeah, I think it was because I decided to do 82 fairly last minute, and I was walking around at, like, you know, with the gear on, like 82 and a bit, 83. So I was like, oh, fuck, I got to cut a kilo. And I didn't really do it properly. I left it to the last minute. Like, I registered on the last day, and you know, it was just a fuck around. So it was a really bad experience. But I know I can easily make 82. I can make it comfortably. I'd be like one of the biggest guys in that bracket. So if I was to compete properly, I would have to compete at 82.
If you're going to Worlds or something, you'd obviously go 82. 100%. But if you had the choice without having to do the work, not because you're incapable of the work, but I'm just saying like to take that out of the equation, if you could, like, you know, red pill, blue pill situation, do you like this weight at 82 or would you prefer to have more muscle and be 88?
I way prefer 88. And this is biased because of, you know, my experiences at 88. I've had more competitions, even if, like, bro, I've weighed in at 82. So I've weighed in competing at 88, but I've weighed in below the limit of the weight back bracket below me. And I felt fine. I felt fucking fine. Like, absolutely fine. I don't know what it is, but no one feels heavy at 88. No one feels strong at 88. Even if they have, you know, technically that 5+ kilos on me, it feels fine. So,
I
don't notice it.
I mean, obviously you're not obviously, but I mean, the amount of conversations you and I have had, I know it's not like you're, you know, have ditched every other aspect of your life and are pursuing jiu-jitsu to go win black belt worlds and whatever. And, you know, like, I'm going to live off, you know, like, what are they, the Padigo submission guys, like, I'm going to live off Panda Express and live on the mats and this, you know. But is putting on more weight a project you would like to take on to, you know, maybe walk around more at 80? You know, you know far better than I do the difficulties in putting on muscle. Like, it's not an overnight thing. But is it a project that you would like to take on to be a bit more – like, oh yeah, I now walk around at 85, 86 kilos or whatever.
Definitely. Absolutely. That was actually one of my missions coming to Sweden. I was like, I'm going to get cardio fit. I'm going to get big. But those two are, like, a little bit counterintuitive. For someone in my position, I've been training, you know, consistently for a decade. It seems crazy to say, but, like, it is very difficult at this stage in my equine development to put on muscle. It is very fucking hard. Not because, like, I've you know, milked as much as I can out of my genetic potential, by no means, but it requires a lot more stimulus, a lot more precision, we'll say, because I've already made all the gains that, you know, would come within a 10-year period of lifting weights. So obviously staying natural, it is you know, that it doesn't seem like a lot. Like, oh, we're only talking about, you know, putting on realistically an extra 4 kilos. But if we're talking about putting on an extra 4 kilos of lean mass, that would take years, bro. It's not my position.
Like, I was, it reminds me of this old YouTube video I watched of, I think it was like cut and pieced together of an old Arnold Schwarzenegger documentary. And it's talking about his time when he was in the military in Austria. And, you know, he essentially didn't have correct weights and stuff. He was, like, putting chairs together to do dips and all this sort of shit. And that in a year... And he's also essentially training by himself. He's not on steroids at this point because he's like 18 years old in the military. Like, he's not on gear. And he said he put on in 1 year 25 pounds of muscle, which, you know, so what, let's say that's 12 kilos or something. And you just go, like, That's fucking insane, bro. That's insane if you're on steroids.
It's possible. With beginner's gains, good genetics, hard training, it's definitely possible. Definitely possible.
Even if we give him the benefit of the doubt and say, okay, let's say you exaggerated it. Let's say you put on 15 pounds of muscle. That's still impressive, bro, to think that like you're a dude in the military. You're not on steroids. You don't have proper equipment. You're in boot camp, but then still going training by yourself, like with nothing but a Reg Park like magazine of telling you the workouts to do, like impressive shit.
Yeah.
Anyway,
the goat, baby. Greatest of all time.
Goat. Well, it's actually reminding me of another thing. So what's the current Mr. Olympia, C-Bum or whatever his name is?
Oh, he's not Mr. Olympia. He's not the Mr. Olympia. He is the men's classic Mr. Olympia.
Oh, okay.
Very specific type.
Okay.
I believe.
What's his name again? No. You know the guy I'm talking about.
Bumstead.
Bumstead, yeah. Chris Bumstead, that's right. And he got asked in the interview, who would win, like you now, like peak you or peak Arnold? And he actually answered it very, like, accurately, I think, whereas he said, well, it depends what the judges are looking for. And he goes, because back in Arnold's day, it wasn't like it is like today. It's like way more important to be crazy lean, like super lean, but it wasn't in Arnold's day. And if you take a side-by-side photo of what Arnold and Chris, like it's night and day, like Chris is way more lean, like crazy lean. He was like, so it depends what the judges would be looking for. He's like, but if Arnold were to compete today against today's judges, he's like, I would win. Because he's not as lean as me, But if I was competing back in Arnold's day, like, would I win? I don't know. Anyway, that's about all I know about bodybuilding. So, let's go into what we're actually talking about, which is calorie deficit, right? Essentially, nutrition, weight loss, those sort of conversations. And so this is, for those who don't know, 100% Kieran's wheelhouse. I mean, obviously, I've had experience, like, making weight for competitions and stuff throughout my years, but I'm by no means someone who knows how to scientifically advise on nutrition. So I just wanted to start with the phrase that everyone says, which is that every influencer says or whoever says that is just along the lines of, as long as you consume less calories than you spend, right, you're in a calorie deficit and you'll lose weight. Obviously, there's, I don't know how you, whether you want to say healthier or the value of the calories, because obviously, the calories in fucking McDonald's cheeseburger differ to calories in spinach or whatever, right? But they kind of say like, well, that's it. It doesn't matter what you eat, in air quotes, as long as you consume less than you spend. So that's where I want to start with. Is that phrase on surface level accurate? Obviously, there's more to it, but where would you step off from there?
Well, yes, it is accurate in a sense because, calories in versus calories out, like you said, Adam, you open up YouTube, you type in calories, and you're going to see someone talking about calorie deficit, calories in versus calories out. The basic concept is you burn more calories than you consume, you lose fat, right? Or you lose weight, at least. Starvation, you lose weight. But there's nuance to it because not all calories are treated the same. And I'm not going to say not all calories are equal because that is also true, but not all calories are treated the same in your body. There's a concept known as the thermic effect of food, which basically states that when the food that you eat has a thermic effect in your body, meaning your body needs to burn calories to digest it, and it's different between the three macronutrients. So depending on what type of calories you're eating, it may not necessarily be equivalent.
Just to make sure myself, I'm on board, to make sure no one else is getting lost. So to put it simply, if you had two different types of food, portions, whatever, and they're both 100 calories worth of food, but in the process of eating and digesting one, you would burn 20 calories, but the other one you would burn 10 calories in the process of eating and digesting. This is what you're talking about.
Let's put it very simple. I'll give you, we'll say that we're eating 100 calories worth of different macronutrient types or different foods, right? If you eat 100 calories worth of fat, you will burn 0 to 3% of that 100 calories. So 0 to 3 calories in processing and digesting that food. If you eat 100 grams of carbohydrate, you will burn 5 to 10%. If you eat 100 grams of, or 100 calories, I should say, of protein, you will burn 20 to 30%. So calories in versus
calories
out.
Holy shit, that is a huge jump. From like, from obviously you start at the bottom when you're talking about fat, but there's good fat, bad fat, 5 to 10, 20
to 30.
But holy shit, protein, like, that, like, does, I don't want to get off topic, but like that, yeah, no, I'm going to leave it at that because I'm going to end up going, but wow, that is a huge jump. Like, you know, you started at 0 to 3%, 5%, 20%. Yep. Like, that's crazy.
20 to 30. Yeah. Jesus. So the thermic effect of food is taken into account when we're considering our BMR. Now we're jumping around a little bit, and this is not going to be a structured, you know, fucking chapter one, chapter two conversation, guys. We're going to be jumping around, but hopefully there's information in here, you know, that's useful. So when we're looking at how many calories we need to burn to be in a calorie deficit, we need to take into account our TDEE, which is our total daily energy expenditure, and a large chunk of that. A very large chunk, particularly for sedentary people or people that aren't, you know, professional athletes, is your BMR or your basal metabolic rate. And out of that, onto that is combined with that is a whole different other factors that make up your resting metabolic rate, right? And sometimes they're grouped together, which is why I'm sort of stumbling. So this is all your non-exercise expenditure of calories burnt. And a part of that is your TEF, which is thermic effect of food, which is the fucking percentages we just listed. Okay.
So now to, I'm gonna try to summarize as we go along. Okay. So cool. Calories in versus calories burnt. So what I picking up that what you were just explaining then was, a more sort of, you were giving the scientific words and the terminology to understand the answer to the question when people type into Google, like, you know, how many calories should I consume in a day? Or, and you'll get something along the lines of Google will spit out for the average person or the average male, it's, you know,
200.
Like 2000 to 3000 calories a day. Obviously depends on, well, are you a 50 kilo male or are you a 120 kilo male? Are you an active, not male, but person, are you active or are you inactive? Like, obviously all those things matter. So if the statement's correct that it needs to be calories in versus calories out, and let's say, yeah, it's 2200 or whatever, calories a day to just maintain. What is, if your goal is weight loss, what is a realistic calorie deficit? If your maintenance level is 2200, do I need to walk around in a day with 2100, or is it 1100, 1500? What is, how much of a deficit do I need to be in to see results? And I should, sorry, before answering that, I'm not, this conversation, guys, is not, I'm not asking in the terms of cutting weight for a competition. I'm asking in the terms of someone who realistic, because everyone has probably heard or is aware of the whole, yeah, you could lose like whatever, 8 kilos in a week, but like you ain't going to keep it off or whatever it is, you know, like the whole, there's a very common conversation as well that it needs to be something that's maintainable and it's over a long period of time, like you'd, so I'm not talking about cutting weight, right? Because I've done extreme weight cuts where I've been on like 800 calories a day, like just stupid, you know, so that's not maintainable. What number, like what's our deficit need to look like if someone is wanting to lose x amount of weight over, you know, we're talking a longer term goal.
You ready?
Yes.
It depends.
Ah, shit.
Yeah, fuck. Okay, so there's a lot of things that you mentioned that we need to expand on. Let's talk about, first and foremost, the elephant in the room. Let's talk about weight cut versus weight loss. They're different. When we talk about weight cutting, we're talking about it in the context of combat sport. We're talking about, when you think weight cut, you think UFC weight cut to make, you know, the big guys that walk around normally at 205 plus pounds, you know, making 185 for like 7 minutes to get on the scales. That is a weight cut because we're cutting water, we're cutting glycogen, you know, we're cutting obviously a bit of body fat along the journey of their fight camp, but that's essentially a water cut. We're looking at water and glycogen cutting for to make weight, right? That is a weight cut. What we're talking about here isn't necessarily weight cutting, it's weight loss. So a slight terminology semantics, but it is important. And I interchange them a lot, and I'm guilty of not, you know, selecting my language when I communicate these ideas. I'm trying to work on that. So yeah, I just wanted to point that out, that we're talking about body recomposition, so losing body fat or losing weight. Okay, now when we say weight loss, there's a lot that goes into weight loss. We could be talking about the loss of total mass, so a combination between fat and muscle, or we could just be talking about the loss of muscle. So that needs, the distinction needs to be drawn there as well. If you take a very obese person, but they just so happen to also be a power lifter, so maybe they're very overweight, but they're, you know, they lift a lot, so they have a lot of muscle. If we put them on a calorie deficit, a severe calorie deficit, to have them lose weight, they will lose muscle as well, because, you know, their body is needing to break down the muscle to fuel to fuel itself, right? So it breaks down the muscle to get access to the protein in that muscle. So that's an important distinction there. So your question is, what level of calorie deficit do we need to lose weight? Well, it depends on who you ask. It depends on the individual. It depends on so many different factors. However, there is a pretty clear-cut formula. You burn, it requires you to be in a deficit of 7,700 calories to burn 1 kilogram of fat. So to lose 1 kilogram of fat, you need to roughly, it equates to needing to lose 7,000, to be in a deficit of 7,700 calories. So if you wanted to figure out how much weight to lose, you would set your weight target, set your time goal, and that would, you can easily calculate what the calorie deficit should be.
Yeah, that's interesting, because like, just to do very simple math, if I go, well, like, okay, let's take, so someone, what would, at a rough estimate, like, you know what I weigh, roughly about 100 kilos, you know more or less my activity level, what would my, at a ballpark, my daily maintenance calorie consumption be?
Ballpark, you're about 100 kilos, 6'4". You're moderately active, fairly active. Like 2,800, roughly, maybe 3,000. Yeah.
So then I think, like, if I go, okay, it's 7,700 calories to lose a kilo. If you wanted to lose a kilo a week, I'm now only hearing the actual, you know, the data, the numbers. That I go, how extreme that is. It's like, well, I'm essentially having to ditch 1,000 calories a day. Mm-hmm. You know, like, that's quite a lot, right? You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's also, I wouldn't necessarily want to do that. Like, say, for example.
No, that's what I'm saying. It's making me think more like, bro, if I were wanting to lose weight and I'm thinking I want to lose a kilo a week, and then I'm hearing those numbers, I go, that's not sustainable. That's like weight cut level shit. You know, that's a huge chunk of calories gone.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, a kilo of fat is a lot of fat, Murray. That's a fucking lot of fat. You see a kilo of fat, like, you know, those science videos where they show you kilo of fat, kilo of muscle. It's a fucking big chunk. It's a big chunk. You know what I mean? So, it's not, you know, it's not insignificant levels of fat. And for those that don't know what a kilo is, it's 2.2 pounds.
Yeah. Yeah, wow. Okay, so that's the basic formula. You go, at 7,700 calories to lose a kilo, this is how many kilos you want to lose, this is your time frame, and you can kind of, then you work out, this is your deficit per day.
Yeah, let's say you wanted to lose 10 kilos very, very ambitiously. And say you're, you know, so that's 77,000 calorie deficit, right? And you're like, okay, so I'm willing to do a 500 calorie deficit per day, which is, you know, not insignificant. That's 154 days. 154 days. Right. And that's 22 weeks, which is very ambitious as well. Like, and it's not as clear cut as that though, because the closer you get to your target, the harder it becomes. Because one thing we need to realize in all of this is that when your weight changes, so does your BMR, right?
Yeah.
If you're giving yourself like 1,000 calories a day, hypothetically, if you did give yourself 1,000 calories a day, your body is going to go into save mode. You're going to burn less calories in the day. You actually see this with bodybuilders who are preparing for shows and things like that, even at the amateur level. When you're on a severe calorie deficit and you've been in there for a while, you stop fidgeting. You stop tapping your foot, like subconsciously, because your body's conserving energy. Mm. So people that like fidget a lot and move around, you slowly reduce that. You stop doing that. Things like, you know, you walk less and just so many different things that go into it.
I had one of my old teammates, Edu Lisboa is his name, and he won Worlds at Purple Belt, and he cut weight for it. And Edu was already a little dude and already really lean, but he went, I can't remember, he went from whatever weight division he was to one below. And man, like, and he won Worlds, so obviously if you asked him, he's going to say it was worth it. I don't think he's ever fought that weight division before, not that I'm aware of. Man, like, I watched this process, like, we were teammates through the whole thing, and it wasn't a huge amount that he had to lose. Like, it was like whatever, 4 or 5 kilos, but because he was already a small dude and pretty lean, it took him like 6 months to do it. And he was so, like, he looked so ill, you know, like he just looked horrific, man. He looked like Christian Bale in The Machinist, sort of. Yeah. Like, he was just so thin, and his face, you could see his cheekbone. But I mean, anyway, he won Worlds, so awesome. But yeah, it took so much longer than if I needed to lose 4 kilos.
Yeah, right? Like, 4 kilos in a week. But oh, yeah, we're talking water.
I could go have some spicy Mexican and lose 4 kilos, bro. Yeah, but
it really depends on the individual, and the leaner you get, the harder it becomes, because you just don't have much fat to lose. There's just nothing there, you know what I mean? So
yeah. So all right, some of the more interesting questions that I wanted to ask was along the lines of, I don't want to say like tips and tricks and hacks and things like that, but and long-term goals can be harder to achieve, especially when it's something like, you know, food cravings and things like that. So if people are on board with, okay, I need to consume less calories, and it needs to be realistically over, it's going to, like you said, even that 28 weeks is ambitious. So realistically, it's going to be over a longer period of time or whatever, right? I've got some tips that I've heard of that I want to ask your opinion on as well, but like, what is your advice for people to essentially, I guess in air quotes, stay motivated, if you will? And some tips will be different for other people. So, you know, sometimes you might say to someone, fucking first thing you do when you wake up in the morning, have a glass of water, you know, or whatever. And for them, that might be something that helps or whatever, or, you know, don't eat after this time at night or whatever. There's obviously lots of different things that could work for individuals, but how do you help someone who's struggling to stay in a deficit for 6 months, 7 months, like for a long, like it's a complete lifestyle change. So how do you help someone with that?
Motivation is it's an interesting one, right? And the textbook answer would be to find intrinsic motivation in what you're doing rather than extrinsic. So the problem with having like a weight loss goal, like it can be very motivating for some people. Some people are very externally motivated, right? Motivated by rewards, motivated by numbers, motivated by what they see on the scale, motivated by getting awarded stripes in jiu-jitsu is an example of something that is extrinsic versus intrinsic motivation, where someone is they seek their motivation and reward for the activity is with the in performing the activity in itself. And that is pretty woo-woo, and it's easy to sit here and say rather than do. But, you know, in a jiu-jitsu context, someone that gets rewarded with stripes or feels like validation with stripes, which is extrinsic, or winning gold at a competition, extrinsic, versus being rewarded by seeing their own progress, by seeing their skill development, intrinsic. Obviously, you can have both, so it's not one or the other. But the people that find the most success with weight loss and the people that find the most success with getting the weight off and keeping it off, they find success by not rewiring their brain, but more like approaching it from a lifestyle standpoint rather than this, I'm trying to get down to 200 pounds or below 200 pounds or achieve the weight I was in high school. Or you hear so many of these, you know, cliche, but very common goals. The problem with that is, what happens once you achieve that goal? Say you came to me and you wanted to, and you were just like a, you know, off the street sort of client that wanted to lose 5 kilos, right? Over, you know, a 2 month period for their wedding or some shit like that. So you come to me, we put you in a calorie deficit. You're really motivated because you want to fit in that suit for your wedding day. You want to look really good, blah, blah, blah. And you achieve your weight loss goals. You have the wedding. And then after that, the motivation of the goal is gone. So you end up putting back 7 kilos. So you're 2 kilos heavier than when you first came to me. And why does that happen? Because you were motivated extrinsically. You're motivated by this goal that you set in your mind. And then once you achieve that, you didn't have anything else to strive for. Whereas someone that, you know, reformats their life or goes into it with the mindset of, hey, this isn't just about achieving a fucking arbitrary, you know, number on the scale that doesn't mean anything anyway. This is about wanting to be healthier, wanting to have more energy, you know, wanting to be a better role model for my kids or whatever. Whatever it is to you, right? If you go into it with that mindset, you're very less likely to yo-yo and rebound, because it's not about achieving some sort of, you know, arbitrary fucking pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. It's different. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does completely. Because you see the yo-yo effect happen all the time, right? You see that we could rename the yo-yo effect the Patty Pimblett effect, you know? but... Yeah, so that 100% makes sense. I want to ask your opinion on some tips and tricks or whatever that I've seen or come across for some more tangible...
actionable.
Not tangible. Yeah. To see what you think of them. Mm-hmm. So one that I've seen that personally works for me, if I'm whether I'm cutting weight or just wanting to be healthier or whatever, and maybe it's because I already enjoy this food, so to speak, but one I see is about volume eating. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean by that? I assume you do, but what I'm saying is, so eating foods that for the volume are really low in calories. So a basic example is like, you know, heaps of leafy greens in a salad or whatever. Obviously, we all know that a salad can be incredibly unhealthy depending on what's in it and what dressing is lathering it. But, you know, whether I'm trying to be healthy, whether I'm cutting weight, whether it's Christmas time or not, I'm pretty on board with eating like leafy greens just as is. Like I can pretty happily, it's not like I sit there and eat a bag of baby spinach on its own, you know, but like I'm happy to eat huge quantities of leafy, salad-y, greeny stuff. So this thing I've seen about volume eating, because you can eat so much more. One that influencers throw around a lot is that like how much more like popcorn you can eat compared to eating Doritos and corn chips and whatever. What are your thoughts on that as an actionable tip for people who are in a calorie deficit?
It's really funny. Whenever I write nutrition programs for someone and it is a calorie deficit, even if it's a substantial calorie deficit and they're coming off of a diet of the standard American diet or the SAD diet, as we call it,
And that's what I remember. I haven't heard that in ages.
Yeah, the SAD, the sad night apt name. And then I, anyway, so I get them off a sad diet, put them on a air quote healthier diet that is high in volume. Even if they're eating way less calories than they were, they're like, fuck, I can't finish all this food. There's so much food, I can barely eat it all. That is temporary. It only lasts a couple of weeks at max. And then all of a sudden, they've gone
Feeling of fullness, yes. Are you talking
yes.
about?
Yes. All of a sudden, they go from, oh my God, I can't fit another bite in. How do you eat all this food? I feel like I'm eating so much. I feel like I'm going to get fat. And then all of a sudden, 2 weeks later, they're begging for more food. They're like, well, not begging, they make it sound like I'm starving them. But they're like, oh fuck, okay, now I'm getting hungry again. Like,
that's interesting.
So quick. Yeah. Like, it's good advice for someone that's not following an actual nutrition plan. If you're actually following a nutrition plan, yes, of course, we need to include voluminous food. Otherwise, you'd feel even more hungry. But that effect of feeling really full when you first go from eating calorie dense foods at like 4,000 calories a day to eating very voluminous, non-calorie dense foods, like low in calorie foods, like the leafy greens, like the popcorn, and like, you know, so many different examples, or potatoes, very satiating, high in protein, very satiating. Then, once you adapt to it, it no longer becomes like a hack, so to speak. It doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, that's interesting. So is that just because physiologically, like in the beginning, your body's like, wow, look at all this, all the physical amount of stuff that's in my belly, but then quite quickly your body learns, hang on a minute, there's not as many calories here as I thought there was.
Exactly. Your stomach expands. You know, so if you are all of a sudden putting a lot more volume into your body, your stomach is going to accommodate for that, and your body will adjust. Your hormones will adjust to it. Your stomach will increase in size, and it will stretch, and it just no longer touches the sides, so to speak. And all of a sudden, you are feeling hungry because you are in a calorie deficit. Now, there's other things that you can do to improve that. Another example onto that I would add to the voluminous food approach is intermittent fasting. Not because intermittent fasting is this magical wonder pill that's going to help you lose weight, you know, without being in a calorie deficit or anything like that. But what it does is it condenses your feeding window so that you are going to feel more full because you are eating more in a shorter time period. Therefore, you're getting more food in your stomach, essentially, in a shorter period before you can clear it.
Well, you've segued to my next question on a tip or a hack or whatever. So I wasn't going to, I guess I was going to loosely use the term intermittent fasting, but not in the rigid, correct form of it. Like, so what I mean is, again, so something that I find might work for me, if I'm just wanting to be like, oh man, I've gotten a bit out of control over the holidays or whatever it is, I might, in little air quotes, intermittent fast in the sense that I might just say like, oh man, I'm not going to eat after this time, or I'm only going to eat in this window, but it is not intermittent fasting because outside that window, I'll drink coffee with milk in it. Like I'll go get a latte or whatever. And, you know, maybe after that window, like I'll have a glass of wine or something. All of these things are breaking the fast, but for me, it at least stops me, you know, buying a muffin with my coffee or whatever. Yeah. And then I've also found sometimes, you know, because I don't do it that regularly, right? Because more or less I kind of just cruise along and maintain the same weight and it's all's good. But, you know, I find that sometimes if I am being a bit stricter, then like what you said, you know, because it's condensed into that little window, and then you eat so much in that window, like you get this feeling of fullness. But it did bring me to another question, like, does that have a negative effect? Because then you're like, it's almost like going out of your way to stretch your stomach because you maybe eat more in one sitting than you typically would because you were so freaking hungry by the time you broke your fast that you just stuff your face, or not really?
You're talking about a rebound effect, which is a common criticism to intermittent fasting as a weight loss strategy. And this is a concept known like, hey, if you only eat within a 6-hour window, will you eat more than you normally would have in order, you know, because you're, like you're saying, stuffing your face. Say you're not counting calories, you're not on a nutrition plan, you're just eating regularly like a normal person, and you decided that you want to lose weight, so you're going to intermittent fast. The criticism against intermittent fasting has been that okay, so if you don't eat until lunchtime, your lunch is going to be larger and so is your dinner. And yet that they have shown in studies that that is true. Your lunch and dinner will be larger than they would have normally been if you're just eating normally, like eating until you're full sort of thing. But
yeah,
where's breakfast, bro?
But yeah.
Where's breakfast? So your total calories in the day are still less with intermittent fasting. They've still shown that despite the fact there is a compensation effect, meaning you're going to eat more in lunch and dinner, because you're skipping an entire meal, it's not enough calories to make up an entire meal worth of compensation. So you're still in a calorie deficit. That is why intermittent fasting works, because it's easier to basically create a situation where you are in a calorie deficit without having to follow a nutrition plan, just because you're skipping a meal, even if there's a little bit of compensation on the tail end.
What I've found for me as well is, and because typically we're going back a ways now, but yeah, like I'll definitely be active with intermittent fasting if I'm cutting weight for a competition. But what I found as well, when I used to do that, is at least for, I'm sure this isn't the case for everyone, but at least for me personally, I found that when it then came to having that first meal of the day, because I was usually pretty hungry by the time you got there, I've naturally craved something, in little air quotes, healthier anyway. You know, like it's like if I had a plate of like whatever, like, let's say, you know, your basic three, whatever it is, fucking protein, veggies and a carbohydrate, or it doesn't, you know, whatever it is, like could be even steak and chips versus, you know, a piece of cake or something. I'd be way more likely to crave the, again, in little air quotes, healthy option, and way more satisfied by that. And I don't know if that's there's some science behind that, or if that's just me personally, I'm not sure, but.
Well, similar to that, there has been research into investigating that question. Like, there is a proponent for, if you are deficient in something, then your body will naturally give you signals in the form of cravings to try and fix that deficiency, right? So if you are deficient in carbohydrate, all of a sudden you'll be craving, I don't know, chips or something, because your body associates that with carbohydrate. There has been research. I'm not super up to date with it, but I don't think it has been debunked, as in found that it's not true. So there is some validity to it. I don't know if that's, you know, if there's robust research, it could be pseudoscience at this point, but that is interesting.
Yeah. And then the only last sort of question I personally had on these sort of tips that, you know, could be little things that add up, was kind of, I segued this thought to, you know, people who have listened to a lot of episodes, probably going way back now, I used to mention Formula One all the time. I used to give heaps of analogies about it, but I don't so much anymore. But I segued there with the whole, you know, like weight's so important in a car. So like if they can make a particular part like 1 gram lighter, and you think, well, what's 1 gram? But when it adds up with like the other part that's 2 grams lighter and this, and all of a sudden they've saved like half a kilo of weight in the car or something. And I thought, one of the other things you see with influencers and whatever talk about is all these like hidden calories or invisible calories. And they're like, oh, you might not realize that that like squirt of tomato sauce or ketchup that you put on something has this many calories, or that, you know, extra dollop of this you put has this many calories, and yada, yada, yada. If you were just talking about someone, like, I guess the question I'm trying to ask is, without going to the side of it's someone necessarily counting calories, how much do you think those little things add up? Like if someone just made changes of, man, get the low sugar tomato sauce, or get the low fat mayonnaise, or get, you know, like these, again, air quote, healthier options, do you think enough of them add up to, you know, if at the end of the day that's 150, 200, 300 calories, I mean, 300 would be a lot, I guess, for condiments, but like it adds up, right?
I don't think 300 is a lot at all. I think that 300 is an underestimate.
Really? What's your thoughts on that? In terms of a tip and a trick, is that something you would like? I don't know. It's obviously not a hack, but is that a direction you would lead people? Like, hey, you know, why don't you try instead of putting full fat milk in your coffee? Yeah, cool. You like milk in your coffee. That's fine. You know, but like maybe just get the skim milk, you know, get the low fat mayonnaise, get the sugar free this, like.
Yep. Yeah, 100%. I'm just Googling because I like to use this very particular, just confirming my numbers, very particular example. So let me paint the picture for you. A large cappuccino, pretty standard, particularly American drink. A latte is probably even worse because it has even more milk. But a large cappuccino or a latte has about 180 calories, depending on where you get it from. You add extra syrup, that the number just goes sky high. 180 calories, right? So you have two of them in a day. That's 360 calories in coffee. Okay, so you have two of them a day for 7 days a week. That's 2,500 fucking calories in coffee, bro.
Yeah.
That's an extra day, over an extra day of eating for the standard individual that's not athletic, the standard fairly sedentary person. That's two fucking coffees. You add in their salad dressings. You add in their soft drink. If you just have, you know, one soft drink a day, that you know, add that in there, add sauces in there, add sugar that people add on, just, you know, if you want a teaspoon of sugar in your coffee, include those calories. Some people put sugar on their fucking cereal, add that.
That's so weird.
You know, tell me about it. So if you add all of these hidden calories or sneaky calories or liquid calories or whatever you want to call them, if you add all them up across a full day, multiply that out a week, all of a sudden, there is your calorie surplus. And then if you go drinking on the weekend, well, fuck, you've just completely blown out. So, I mean, if you're asking the question, if substituting these types of food, is it really worth it? Does it really make a difference for the vast majority of people, depending on what we're substituting? Yes, it does. It makes a huge, huge, huge fucking difference. I've assigned calorie deficit programs. I've had people that are actually counting their calories and then they're like, oh, my weight's not really going down. What's happening? And I'm like, okay, let's break this down. You know, initially I'm like, oh, just give it a chance. You know, your body needs to respond, blah, blah, blah. But then when we get to the end of week three and the weight has not moved a fucking an inch, there's like, okay, something's happening here. So when we look at it, we're like, okay, you have this salad, for example, on your nutrition plan. Talk to me about how you prepare that salad. And it's like, oh yeah, this, this, and this. And then do you add salad dressing? Oh yeah, heaps. I'm like, well, that's the fucking problem. All of a sudden, that 400 calorie meal has gone to 700-800 calories. Or that's a bit of an exaggeration, but you get the point. It makes a huge, huge difference. Now, am I saying that everyone needs to, you know, watch everything that they eat in terms of sauces and things like that? No, only if you're interested in losing weight. If you're not interested in losing weight, then you could ignore this advice. It's not, you don't need to avoid these foods to be, air quote, healthy. You just, if you're in a calorie deficit and you're not losing weight and you're wondering why, it's probably in the fucking coffees, bro.
Yeah. So then I just wanted to round out my questions or the things that I was curious about your point of view on this topic, was I now wanted to kind of end it with not the other end of the conversation, but because I was more curious on how do you approach a longer term goal that, you know, can be hard to maintain, is that, what is your advice, or how do you deal with clients or people who they have one bad day and then they go, oh, well, like, I fucked the whole thing now, like, which I don't think is the case, right? Like, you know, you have, you know, it's not like, you know, maybe let's take that goal of losing the 10 kilos and maybe you've lost 5 kilos and then you had a bad day because you went to a wedding or you had an argument with someone and you just, you know, whatever it was. It's not like you then overnight put on 5 kilos.
No.
Right? Like, obviously you I don't know if derailed's the right word, but I mean, you get the question I'm trying to ask, right? Like, I don't want to say cheat day because some people are very good with that rigidity and whatever, and it works for them. I don't want to use that term, but I guess I'm trying to say, how do you communicate to people that, man, it's okay that you like fucked up on one day, you haven't undone the last like 12 weeks that you've been working towards this goal. Like, it's okay. Like, just keep going. How do you try to communicate that to people?
That's a tough one. It depends on the individual. And this really, really, really does depend on the individual. Everyone is unique. So sometimes, you know, and that's, it's a difficult part about, you know, if you are going to be a coach and you are coaching people, particularly through something like nutrition or, you know, following nutrition guidelines and an exercise program to achieve a goal, it is a little bit like a counselor. It is a little bit like, you know, you're taking them through it. Obviously, I don't work with people with eating disorders and things like that. I'm not qualified to do that. So you need to see a dietitian and blah, 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 blah. But, you know, let me start this off with a story. I had a friend who was a nutrition coach for bodybuilding. So specifically to prep people for amateur bodybuilding. A lot of the time it's their first competition, maybe it's not, but the amateur level, natural bodybuilding. And he had a client that was doing something like a 16 to 20 week preparation to step on stage and compete in bodybuilding. So you need to be very, very lean and you know, it's quite difficult. You're following a rigid calorie deficit for 20 weeks, nearly 6 months. It's a long time. That's a big commitment. He had this one client who was something like 2 or 3 weeks out from stepping on stage, gives him a call one night at like 9 p.m., answers the call, sees it's his client, has a chat with him, and he's like, I'm sitting in the car park of McDonald's. I just had 2 family boxes to myself. Just absolutely went off the rails, just snapped, right? The calorie deficit was too much. There was too much pressure. There were, you know, too much anxiety around competing. You know, the calorie deficit was too extreme. They're too fatigued, starved, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, they went completely off the rails. And I think that from that moment, it created like a floodgate and they never end up stepping on stage. They just pretty much, you know, stepped away from it, rebounded, so to speak. So that does happen to a lot of people. Those sorts of people shouldn't be competing in bodybuilding. but to get back to the
is
point.
Is this the story of how you left bodybuilding?
No. I had the opposite problem. But the point is that, you know, people respond differently to different scenarios. People respond differently depending on how extreme you're taking it. Some people cannot have a cheat day at all. Some people cannot allow themselves that because it does, you know, something cracks and the floodgates open and then everything falls apart. So I've had clients that, you know, have gone out on a night on the piss, gotten smashed, you know, had all the burgers, did whatever basically. And in their mind, they'd already failed. So they gave up and they just ghosted me. I've had people block me. I've had people pay me like $1,000 for a 16-week fucking prep. This is, you know, not recently, but I've had people pay me a lot of money to be their coach and write them a program and do all these things. And then like 3 weeks in, they just fucking block me on social media. And I'm like, what the where did they go? Like, you know, I've had people, and not everyone just blocks me, but some people just completely ghost me. Just leave me on read or just don't reply because obviously something's happened. Obviously, you know, they've gone off the rails. They don't want to follow the nutrition plan anymore. And they think that is the only option, right? That is not the only option. There are so many things that you can do, not to, you know, mitigate the damage or any other sort of negative fucking terminology, but there's so many other alternatives. If following a nutrition plan is not right for you, there's so many other ways of achieving your goal. You don't need to follow a nutrition plan. It's just one of the most effective ways to do it. So the point is there are so many different workarounds. What do I tell people that after they've had one bad day, I totally brush it off. It doesn't matter. It really does not matter. Like in the long term of things, if you want to achieve a healthy weight, if you're not trying to get on stage bodybuilding, if you're not trying to, you know, make weight in 4 days for a jiu-jitsu competition, if you're just trying to get healthier, it doesn't matter if you go to a wedding and have a good time. If anything, I encourage it. I encourage you to go to a wedding and have a good time. I encourage you not to count your fucking calories at the wedding. I encourage you not to pull out my fitness hour, take a photo of the fucking cake, like weigh it out and fucking put the wedding cake on the scales and make sure it fits your fucking macros. No, don't be a loser. Don't be that weird person. That will make you unhealthy. And that is a sign of an eating disorder. If you are doing that, I'm sorry to say that that is a telltale sign of an eating disorder developing. So you need to be very, very aware of that. But the point is that it does not matter in the long term. What matters is what you do on a weekly basis. What matters is what you do consistently. What matters is what you do daily. Like, what matters is how many coffees you drink, bro. Like, I'm not even kidding. Rather versus the fucking cake at the wedding. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, yeah, because that's, you know, like you said, if you're cutting weight for a comp that's 4 days out, obviously you can't afford a bad day because that's 25% of, you know. Yeah. But like, you know, obviously if you extrapolate that out over to someone who's trying to go on a weight loss journey over a year, well, you know, 25% would be a 3 month bender, you know, like that's different. Like over a year, one day or like multiple bad days. I don't want to say, like, depends how many is multiple, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, that's
like,
true. That is true. And I've had clients that their weight hasn't gone down from week to week and they're in, you know, week two of their thing. And I'm like, dude, like, chill.
That's another thing.
Weight trend over 12 weeks. You're looking at trends. You're not looking at, you know, day to day, week to week. Don't weigh yourself every day.
That's another thing that people perhaps are not aware of is that even when operating in a calorie deficit, how much your weight can fluctuate. Like maybe it doesn't fluctuate as much if you literally ate the exact same thing every day. I'm not sure, but you know, even food aside, things with stress and whatever else. And I don't weigh myself often. You know, if I'm weighing myself daily, it's only if I'm coming up to a competition that I'm having to make weight for, right? But I don't weigh myself often. But coincidentally, like the other week or something, I weighed myself 2 days in a row because I had just changed the scales in the battery in the scales, right? So I used it 2 days in a row, didn't change anything in what I ate, probably ate more from one day to the other, but like lost something like a kilo and a half. I didn't literally lose a kilo and a half from one day to the other in terms of, I didn't lose 1.5 kilos of fat in a day.
Here's
no,
an experiment you can do. If you want to see how much your weight can fluctuate, weigh yourself first thing in the morning and then go take a shit. Weigh yourself again. The weight difference is literally what you just shout out. But in all seriousness, your weight can fluctuate up to 30 kilos in a 24-hour period, and that is completely normal. And that's 6.6 pounds, so nearly 7 pounds in a 24-hour period, and it'd be normal, depending on the individual, the size of the human, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like that's the thing, right? When it comes to how much weight is on the scale, it doesn't fucking matter. What we care about is your body composition, how much body fat you have versus how much muscle you have. We don't really care, in a sense, air quotes, how much water retention you have at that given point in time. Like, are you supplementing for the first time with creatine? Did you just start supplementing with creatine? Well, a lot of people, depending on the size of the human, have a bit of water retention associated with that. Cool. How much sodium have you been intaking? Is your sodium up or down? Water retention. How much glycogen is in your muscles? Have you been sweating? Are you dehydrated? Did you just finish training? Have you taken a shit? Is your bladder full? Have you eaten a lot of food that's, you know, working its way through your digestive system? Are you high in stress? Is your cortisol levels high? Cortisol levels make you retain more water. There's so many different things that go into your weight on the scales. Like if you're interested in a weight loss journey, we're really talking about a fat loss journey. No one's out there with too much muscle being like, oh, I want to lose some muscle. But the point is that the people get too hung up on the number on the scales when it doesn't tell the full story. It only tells a story when we look at, when we zoom out and look at it through the lens of time, through the lens of a month to month period. That's when we can really see the trend.
Yeah, people are too focused on the number, especially at our gym, man. People always tell me to step on the scales when it's nighttime and I've just eaten and I'm in my gi and I'm like, well, of course I'm going to be fucking heavy. Leave me alone. Students pick on me.
It's one of those jiu-jitsu things where they're like, after the it's one of those backhanded compliments where they're like, oh, you know, how much do you weigh? After you just smash them in a roll.
Well, yeah, actually tonight got on the scale with Adzi, you know, Adzi, yep. Man, guess how much weight was between us? Me and Adzi. This was again tonight getting on the scale, nowhere near what he weighs. Dude, only 3 kilos between us.
Yeah, he's about 95.
Yeah, he was like 96. But he's like, man, in the morning, I'm like 90, 92. And I'm like, yeah, of course. Like, you're weighing yourself now at the end of the day. Like, you know,
you're in a gi, the gi is wet, your stomach's full.
Yeah. Just to finish with the coffees, I'll give a little tidbit. Here's a tip of how you can reduce your coffee calorie intake by being lazy. So I've got like an espresso machine at home, you know, like the one you had. And so I'll make mine and my wife's coffee in the morning. But the milk jug, and I always like stronger coffees anyway, right? I always have a strong coffee. And the milk jug to steam the milk is not quite big enough for the milk for two, because like we drink like lattes or whatever. It's so fancy. So then I'll just steam the milk and I'll pour hers, and then I'll just have the remainder of the milk. And like, so sometimes it works out to just be like the espresso with like a tiny bit of milk or whatever. And I'm like, yeah, whatever. I couldn't be fucked steaming more milk. So then I just drink it like that. I'm like, yeah, it's stronger. It's less milk. And so there you go, guys. You can be lazy and save calories.
What I used to do and what I recommend to people if they like coffee with milk is make an Americano or a long black and put a dash of milk, just enough to get the flavor of the milk to change the color of it. And make sure it's skim milk and blah, blah, blah. And it's fuck all calories. There's no calories in coffee, FYI.
Are there regular milk compared to all the preferred nut milks that people are into, at least in Australia? I don't know if it's internationally. Are they super calorie dense, the nut milks, like almond milk, macadamia milk and all that?
There's a lot of sugar in a lot of them. It really depends on what your... you know, what type of nut milk you're looking at, but not really. They're not super calorie dense at all. It all depends on what you're looking at. If you're looking at like you can get barista fucking almond milk, and they can be pretty dense and lots of sugar. But I mean, you only really need to go with nut milks if you prefer to, if you know you're plant-based, or if you have some form of allergy, or you know, like lactose intolerant, or you have some sort of other dairy allergy, then go for nut milks. I personally have a dairy allergy, so I have either oat milk or almond milk. I know there's a lot of water used, but you know, whatever. Shut up.
All right. Fuck, man, that was great. That was actually like super, like hopefully everyone enjoyed that, but that was super informative for me. Some of the things that like you just see online that, you're like, of someone, you know, an actual educated opinion on this, because any asswipe can just post something, you know. But
this asswipe's gonna put no.
Yeah.
I did want to mention one thing before we just as a final piece, and this is hopefully doesn't open another can of worms, but this is something I want to talk about because this is beyond jiu-jitsu, right? A lot of people come to jiu-jitsu as a form of weight loss. And my opinion on this has changed over the years, but my current stance is fantastic. It's great. It's accessible. It's a fun way to do a sport. It's a fun way to burn more calories. You know, if that's your goal. And it's a really fun way to get fit, right? We can both agree to that. But one thing you will find, if you come to jiu-jitsu for weight loss and say your diet does not change, when you first start, you may start losing weight. But eventually, you will get to the point where you're not losing weight anymore and you're gaining weight. And that is because you will become better, hopefully, at jiu-jitsu, more efficient at jiu-jitsu. Therefore, you're not really burning that many calories. Yeah, you're really good at jiu-jitsu and you're still having fun, but you know, you're not really burning calories with jiu-jitsu. And that it's kind of funny. It's like a bit of a meme, if you will, that once you get to brown belt, you start to get fat because your jiu-jitsu is too efficient, that it's not really the exercise that it used to be. And that's just something that I want to point out to people, that, and that's where a calorie deficit, you know, in terms of your nutrition side, is going to be important.
Yeah, that's a great point to make. All right, well, onto my little something interesting I wanted to share, which was just something to think about. I was listening to an older episode of the Lex Fridman podcast, and he had on there Walter Isaacson. Walter Isaacson. It was episode 395 of the Lex Fridman podcast. And Walter is an author who's written like the biographies for Elon Musk, Steve Jobs, Albert Einstein, Benjamin Franklin, like a lot of very important people in history and uber successful people. And one of the things that they were talking about was how this is by no means mandatory, but it is a very common factor amongst a lot of successful people, which is essentially coming from a difficult place, like having a hard childhood or having internal demons or whatever it is, right? And that's where the conversation sort of started, and they spoke a lot about Elon Musk and, you know, how horrible his father was to him and a lot of trauma that happened in Elon's youth. And, you know, and I think casually most people are aware of this phenomenon, or especially in sports as well. You see, like, you know, a lot of the best football players out of Brazil come from the favela and whatever. But it just made me make the jump to be like, because I was just happened to be listening to this episode, and I was like, oh, I've never thought about that for jiu-jitsu athletes. Like, I wonder if you did a survey of all the top guys across the last, you know, well, I mean, it's a relatively new sport in terms of history of sports, but, you know, if you took the most successful guys over the last, you know, 2-3 decades and, you know, found out how many of them had, you know, super shit childhoods, or how many of them came from, like, you know, had this internal drive that, again, Walter, the author who had written all these autobiographies for these people, doesn't say it's mandatory. There's plenty of successful people who don't, but he's like, it is a very common recurring factor across successful, uber successful people that they have this, you know, and that festers into some sort of drive that other people just don't have. And it just made me think about it for jiu-jitsu. Oh, I wonder how many of the top guys in jiu-jitsu have this drive because of factors like that, because of coming from poverty or, you know, abusive families or whatever it is. And that was I was just going to say that was my something interesting, just that I was listening to that. Again, it's episode 395 of the Lex Friedman podcast, but it was just my thought on how many of the top guys would have that drive due to factors that Walter was talking about in the episode.
I'd say so many, and this is like, I've heard this from many different people, and as recently as yesterday, Alex Hormozi is a business content creator that I love, and he had a video, like a vertical video from a presentation he gave, like a speech that he gave. And he said that there are three common factors they find in the uber successful, the successful in business, right? One is they have this feeling, people have this feeling that they're better than everyone else. Two, they have this, the unshakable feeling that they're never good enough. And three, they have a singular focus. And I think that talks volumes to coming from hardship, because one thing where people come from hardship is they always have something to prove. They have, you know, that phrase, like you have a chip on your shoulder. You're always like striving to, you know, you never feel like you're good enough because you were told as a child you're never good enough, sort of thing. Like, it's fucked up, but it's true. And you combine that with intelligence and a high work drive and you know, other factors that stars have to align to be successful, then it makes sense.
Yeah. So, yeah, I just thought it was interesting when I then took that, I think, relatively well-known sort of idea that a lot of successful people have that drive due to coming from difficult places. But I just never kind of had the thought of like, hey, wonder how many of the top jiu-jitsu guys, that's why they have that. But yeah, because a lot of athletes have it, come from poverty or whatever. But yeah, anyway, that was my little thing.
That's your little thing?
Yeah. What you got for me, man? What do you got?
Okay, so this is old news by the time this releases. But for those that don't know, USADA is leaving the UFC. Technically UFC has split ways with USADA. USADA is the United States Drug Administration, Anti-Doping Administration. What the fuck am I even saying? It's the United States Anti-Doping Administration. I believe they're affiliated with WADA, which is the World Anti-Doping Agency. I think
Association. WADA is what is used with the Olympics and everything.
Yes. Let me get that right. So it's the United States Anti-Doping Agency, USADA. Sorry for everyone. I fucked that up many, many times. But the CEO, Travis Tygart, made a statement not only did they part ways, but USADA actually announced this, unbeknownst to UFC, that they were going to make an official statement. And, you know, he the CEO put out like a very lengthy, you know, very whingy statement, but I just wanted to read a little bit from it. So we can confirm that Conor McGregor has re-entered the USADA testing pool as of Sunday, October 8th, 2023. We have been clear and firm with the UFC that there should be no exception given to the UFC for McGregor to fight until he has returned 2 negative tests and has been in the pool for at least 6 months. The rules also allow USADA to keep someone in the testing pool longer before competing based on their declarations upon entry in the pool and testing results. Unfortunately, we do not currently know whether the UFC will ultimately honor the 6 month or longer requirement, because as of January 1st, 2024, USADA will no longer be involved with the UFC anti-doping program. He said a bunch of other things as well in there, but basically the USADA CEO is saying that because of Conor McGregor, or how UFC is treating the Conor McGregor situation, that is why UFC is effectively firing USADA. Dana White, the CEO of UFC, made a statement in a press conference in response to these comments, and he said, "I summed it up yesterday in one word: scumbag." And he goes, "Listen, it is what it is. They did what they did. Think about it." This is a really bad quote. But basically, he's saying that. To summarize it, he goes, "Listen, this guy went full Britney Spears and lost his mind. He's a scumbag. You know, he's this and he's that." He just went on like a 10-minute rant about how this guy went full Britney Spears and had a bitch. And look, to be honest, man, I think that it is funny the way Dana White responds to this. And it's like, you know, social media high school drama almost. But at the same time, I don't think USADA should put out a statement putting UFC on blast publicly without their knowledge. But, I mean, it's kind of funny.
So what does that mean for UFC, though? Because they, need to find another body that does testing?
They've already found one. It's the Drug-Free Sport International is replacing USADA as of the 1st of January 2024. And who is the Drug-Free Sport International? Well, they run the anti-doping program for CrossFit, PGA, NBA, NFL, MLB, NBA, NASCAR, the horse racing in the United States. So they're a US-based company. So is USADA, obviously. And apparently USADA subcontract the Drug-Free Sport International frequently to perform testing for them. They have 2,000 testers or something ridiculous across the country. So they're very reputable. And so they're going forward. There's some guy from the UFC. I don't know his position. I think he might be the UFC's internal guy that runs their anti-doping program. Made a statement, basically, a very, very lengthy statement, saying that Drug-Free Sport International will be replacing them as the third-party independent body that is running the program, and that it's going to be even more transparent, more comprehensive, more this, more that. So nothing's going to actually change with their anti-doping. I don't think it's going to be easier to dope in UFC. If anything, I don't think it's going to change at all. But time will tell. I could be wrong. Yeah.
But either way, Conor McGregor will be back in no time.
Yeah. And he is saucy.
Yeah, that's right.
Man, to be honest, like, hey, this is going to get me some hate, but I was talking about this very topic with a friend of mine the other day. And to be honest, man, if you actually are a fan of MMA and you like, well, UFC, let's be honest, no one watches fucking Bellator. If you're actually a fan of UFC, the organization, the fights and everything, and you follow the sport, you've forgotten about McGregor years ago. Like, no offense to him, but you know, his last performances weren't super great. Yes, he is a superstar in terms of he brings in all the casuals, as they say, even though I consider myself a casual. But I don't know, man. I think that the sport itself is so goddamn entertaining. There are some really, really top quality, amazing fighters. You know, McGregor's just one guy. I don't know. That's my take on it.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not a fan of him, so I couldn't really care less. But, you know, yeah, be interesting. I mean, it won't be great for him if he makes his return and then loses, will it?
He will definitely make his return and lose, unless they throw, like, someone to the wolves and throw him, like, unranked person and, you know, whatever.
Yeah, fuck, who knows. Anyway, Guys, that is us. Thank you so much for listening if you made it this far. I'm looking forward to next episode, 155, going over the positions that Kieran and I have been working on over the previous 10 or so weeks. So I'm excited to go into detail about that. As always, any questions, you know where you can reach us at beyondjujitsu_podcasts, or you can message Kieran directly, or you can message me directly. Fuck, we're very accessible. I mean, I had a guy come into the gym. What are you laughing at?
This is such a low energy.
Oh my God, if you feel like you need to message us. No, but we're very accessible. I mean, I had a guy come in and train tonight, actually, visit the gym, and We were mid-roll, and he was like, oh, I forgot to tell you, I listened to the podcast. It's so weird to roll with you. And I was like, thanks, bro. So, very accessible, guys. You know where to catch us. Anyway, my outro's done. Thank you so much. We'll catch you next time.
See ya.